The following is a CNA podcast.
My climate conversation today is about food security. Why, when we talk about climate change, extreme weather events, and changes in our oceans and sea levels, underlying all the challenges is one really big one. How we all need to start thinking about where our food comes from. Not just where it comes from, but also where it won't come from. How little there may be, and what specific food groups may be affected, and what can be done about it. I'm Jamie Ho, and thanks for listening to The Climate Conversations. With me to talk about this is Dr. Paul Teng. Paul is an adjunct senior fellow for food security at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies in NTU in Singapore. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
We've spoken about agriculture as a source of emissions in the past episode, but in broad terms, maybe to frame our discussion, if I'm in the business of agriculture and I eat and drink as well and you eat and drink as well, what do we need to be aware of in terms of climate change?
Well, for one, you know, climate change will definitely affect agriculture. And because agriculture is the main source of food production at the moment, we can expect food production to be affected by climate change, basically. Huh? That's the top level kind of, you know, answer usually.
Yes.
If you want more detail, then I've got to unpack, you know, what it means.
Yes, do that.
And this is where food security comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather, our concern is not so much about food security, but food insecurity, the lack of food. Now, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, we think about food security in four dimensions in today's world. The first is what we call making sure that food is available. Second is to make sure that it is accessible physically. The third really is to make sure that it's affordable. And the fifth is a duo of nutrition and safety, because those two are often interlinked. So let me unpack each one of those, because this, I'm sure, will be of interest to your listeners. Huh? In terms of availability, in Singapore, as we all know, we only produce less than 10% of our own food. So 90% comes from overseas. So forever in Singapore, we're always going to be vulnerable and susceptible to how climate change affects those countries, the 170 countries or so that we import our food from. However, making food available in Singapore is not just through imports. We're also growing our own, and then we also have some stockpiles. And of course, we also have companies from Singapore investing overseas where direct supply chains come back.
Singapore companies,
yes. The best example, you know, is the government-to-government, you know, arrangement that we have with China in Jilin province. There's an area there that's multiple times the size of Singapore, you know, and the hope is that, you know, that area, by using Singapore know-how and investment, will generate enough food, okay, where the surplus can come back to us. And we're already starting to see a rise from Jilin coming back here to China. Now, then in terms of self-production, I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about the 30 by 30 goal, where we aspire to produce 30% of our nutritional needs by 2030. Now, what a lot of our listeners perhaps don't have more detail on is that in the 30 by 30, we intend to do several things in Singapore. One is to up our urban agriculture and urban aquaculture, which is fish production. Second is to up our protein production through what we're calling now alternative proteins or future food. And this is where, you know, cultured meat, you know, and again, the most, you know, kind of a visible one in the media is shuk meats. And there's a lot of talk about that, you know, in media coverage. Yeah? But we're also trying to do the same in Singapore for plant-based protein, for microbial protein, and other kinds of protein, alternative proteins, basically. Now, the third aspect really is related to food safety standards, in a sense, being very proactive. Because as climate change affects our supply lines, we think that the quality of food will likely be affected, especially at the front end near the farms that don't have cold chain management. So that's kind of a long story around making food available.
Okay.
Now, even if we are successful in the 30 by 30, there will still be 70% of our food coming from overseas. So we also have to be very conscious, in fact, of how the countries that we import our food from are reacting to climate change.
Exactly. So let's start with the import part of the equation. Much has to be done to raise awareness, as you suggest, of just where our food comes from.
Right.
And if you think about the main sources for the various food groups, and probably regionally as well, what concerns you the most? Which country and what are the problems those countries face that concerns you the most as it impacts on Singapore?
We depend on about 12 major countries for most of our food, basically. And for things like fresh vegetables, a big chunk of it, in fact, comes from neighboring countries. Malaysia is a case in point. It's the same with eggs. A lot of eggs come from Malaysia. Now, vegetables are a good example. If climate change, in fact, comes up with negative effects, like say too much rain, drought, you
and
know,
it, high temperature. It has and it will, yeah.
And it's happened before. Vegetables in the Cameron Highlands, for example, in the highlands are also affected. So then the supply to us is lessened.
Mm.
And then fish is the other one. We import a lot of fish from Malaysia. When there are storms, when it's inclement weather, the supply of fish that is harvested is reduced. Mm. And there's been cases in the past where Malaysia said that they're going to temporarily reduce
because of that,
the shipment
yeah.
because of this, you know. So yeah, we were certainly very susceptible. And then going further afield, like North America, South America, in fact, those two regions are major sources of imports for us.
Mm.
And also animal feed. Okay, we import a lot of animal feed from the Western Hemisphere. Several years ago, there was a big drought in North America. Soybeans were short. Prices went up. So the net result is that because of soybean shortage, animal feed, chicken feed, fish feed are all affected. So there's a competition. Prices go up.
Yeah.
And the net result is our fish prices go up, our chicken prices go up. So we're really living in a very interlinked world.
One of the things which obviously in recent months, COVID-19 has brought up to people's awareness as well. Talk about the 30-30 target.
Yeah.
It would appear to me that we probably have to be a little bit more ambitious than that as well, because again, just by sheer natural effect of climate change, supply will be more and more inconsistent as well. At the very least, it will be inconsistent, if not curtailed.
There are limits to how much more Singapore can self-produce.
Yeah.
As we all know, the land, the water and so on, you know. Now, the positive flip side of this argument is that I think we're a pretty innovative society in Singapore. We're very technology-oriented. And that's where I sometimes tell people, you know, we shouldn't think too much of our limitations like land. We should think of space.
Mm.
And it's already starting to happen. Like with vertical farms, right? We expand the planting dimension from one dimension to two dimensions, going upwards. So straight away, we can increase our productivity tremendously. But having said that, there are only certain food items that we can grow in Singapore. Right now, leafy vegetables, very common example, fish, over 100 fish farms, you know, eggs, for example. And then we've got, you know, small amounts of like, you know, frogs and stuff like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we need to ask the question, is it possible for Singapore to even grow rice? Interestingly enough, the answer technically is yes, we can.
How so?
But at what cost?
Okay? Well, cost is a very important point, and maybe I'll use rice as a good point to talk about cost, because at the end of the day as well, a lot of it is cost.
That's
if
right.
we want to diversify our sources of imports, it's cost. If we want to grow our own stuff, it's cost.
It's cost, yes.
Is that a necessary, I would say, eventuality that Singaporeans need to get used to as well, in that not just Singapore, but most people have to start thinking about paying a bit more for their food, if not a lot more?
As somebody who researches this, if you look at the mid to long term, I would say yes.
Mm.
It's inevitable that food prices will go up, not just because of climate change, but for other reasons as well, you know, demand, you know, and so on. So yes, I think the overall answer is yes. But at the same time, because we're surrounded by so many other countries that are low-cost countries with lots of land, you know, if we continue importing and there's no supply chain interruption, then we can expect to also import food that is cheaper than what it costs us to produce here. And that's our strategy basically in Singapore. Continue, you know, the supply lines from outside. Even if we're successful in 30 by 30, the other 70% will still come from outside, right? What we need to do in Singapore then is how do you become price competitive with the imports? Now, one is, of course, you know, to keep focusing on technology, which is why our ministers also keep saying productivity, productivity, productivity. We've got to increase productivity. And certainly technology is one way to do that. Now, something else too, I think, which is, you know, going back to public outreach, public mindset, we may have to be prepared to pay a bit more for food that we produce ourselves, support our locally produced food, basically.
Yes, okay? Yes.
And this is where the arguments are quality, freshness, and also having what is now increasingly an important term, some resilience to buffer against shortages when we have, you know. And if we don't, you know, help to support our local, you know, farmers, yeah, then in times of crisis, we're really totally vulnerable and exposed to overseas.
I mean, it all comes down to cost as well, because I've had the luxury of living in Switzerland for a little bit of my life for a couple of years. And I think the mentality that people have there is that they're willing to pay a little bit more for the assurance that the quality of the meat or the vegetables
that's
that
right.
come from Switzerland are higher than the rest of Europe.
That's right.
As someone who studied this, besides getting people used to the cost, do you think there's enough awareness that the food that comes from Singapore is different? And do you think over time people will be willing to pay a little bit more for that?
I think a lot more public outreach needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And our former AVA, and not SFA, has in fact tried public education programs before. Mm. You know, but this has got to be done consistently and repeatedly. Yeah, as we all know, I think advertising is about repeating the message many, many times, you know. Now, it's also, I think, very encouraging that, you know, we're seeing some of these messages being given at the school level. And as an educator myself, you know, I really believe that, you know, the younger generation is where you start making a difference.
Mm.
And it's not just about food, it's also about waste.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know.
If you look at cost, and eggs always is a very good example of just the variance in cost and impact that this has, because we know that imported eggs from Malaysia are usually the cheapest.
Right.
And as you go further afield, it gets more and more expensive.
Right.
We are beginning to import them by air as well.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose a proof in the pudding is whether or not people are willing to pay a little bit more for these eggs. And therefore, if the eggs were to come from Singapore as well in greater and greater numbers, or whether or not that actually meets the market test. As you say, it needs resilience as well.
Yeah.
Using the example of an industry like eggs, isn't it necessary to keep the industry going at a certain level on a day-to-day basis to meet the eventualities of a crisis?
It is. And you know, and also, I think studies have shown that there's a kind of a price barrier, which I think consumers are willing to bear, the substitute for quality.
Mm.
Okay, and that's usually around 10-15%
from
what I've seen. Huh? Anything beyond that, I think, creates a lot of pain points for most consumers.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, there will always be parts of our population who are looking for niche products, who are willing to pay much more. Organic food, you know, specialist food and so on. Huh? But basically, our concern always has been about the mass market because you need to feed the majority of people. And this is where the price sensitivity is so high still, you know. I sometimes get a bit ambivalent about, you know, how you can trade off between local production, quality, freshness, you know, with price.
Yes.
I don't think there's a single answer, frankly.
we'll have to see. And I suppose it will depend product by product even sometimes.
Yes.
And speaking about products, then therefore, I mean, individual items. If you think about consumer eating habits as well, and this is something which has come up in past podcasts, in a way, changing habits also complicates food supply because... it's a bit of a vicious cycle. The demand for things like livestock, beef, and things like that goes up. That has its own climate impacts as well.
Right.
How much do you think needs to be done there as well? And is there capacity for that too?
I think a lot of education needs to be done on that aspect. I think a lot of consumers don't really appreciate the fact that, you know, like eating more animal protein, for example, has such big negative impacts on the environment. Most people don't think beyond just the price, unfortunately.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes when I tell my class, you know, to produce 1 kilo of beef requires 16,000 kilos of water.
Mm-hmm.
That much, you know. So if you start eating something else that has lower water footprint, you're really doing a tremendous job in terms of helping the environment. Our freshwater resources are declining rapidly all over the world, especially in Asia. You know, and the same goes with feeding protein to the other animals so that people can eat the animal protein, that the conversion ratios sometimes are very inefficient itself, you know. So why not eat more vegetable-type protein instead of eating animals which are converting your animal vegetable protein into animal protein?
Yeah.
But you're right, though. You see, food is such a personal thing.
Yes.
Personal choices very strongly influenced by our legacy mindsets. I was just discussing this the other day with somebody else. This movement now towards cultured meat. Now, if I were eating chicken rice, I want to see chicken.
You want to see the whole thing,
exactly, the bones, you know.
Plus the skin, plus the meat,
and so on, you know. The technology is not quite ready yet, I mean, at the moment. Maybe in 10, 20 years' time, the technology can be there for us to totally reproduce a whole fish or whole chicken.
Goodness me,
We don't know, actually, the way technology is advancing so fast, especially the food technology. I mean, there's so much investment and interest now. Because as you said earlier, you know, food is so fundamental. It's an existential thing, you know, that we all have to eat.
If you were to give an expert's assessment of Singaporeans' food habits, and I would say, you know, if you could give some recommendation and we change it immediately, both from a perspective of food security as well as, you know, climate change related reasons, what are the main things you think we could review as a people?
I would start off first by reducing food waste, because that is a major concern.
Yes.
For a small country, we do waste a lot of food.
Okay.
Now, the second then is, you know, do we need to eat as much as we're eating? This is linked to the food waste issue.
Yes.
Yeah, I would put it that very often we tend to overeat. And that also creates another kind of problem, you know, the obesity issues and so on.
Huh? Yeah.
Now, the third then would be, you know, asking ourselves, do we need to eat as much animal protein as we do today? I speak for myself, you know, I actually become a flexitarian.
What does that mean?
It means that I consciously try to only eat vegetarian for breakfast and lunch.
Okay.
Breakfast is easy. Toast, you know, yeah. Peanut butter and so on, you know. Lunch is a bit more difficult.
Yeah.
Like at NTU, you know, there are very few stalls that are fully vegetarian.
Yes.
Okay, so I have to go for special stalls, you know, to get my vegetarian stuff, you know. Now, for dinner is where I make it up.
Not bad.
At least I can say, look, you know, I've tried. You know, to at least, you know, reduce my footprint. And hopefully, you know, if more people feel this way, I think every individual effort then adds up and makes a difference.
Yeah.
It really does, you know. But we need education, lots of education, outreach programs.
Yeah. I mean, if you go look at Singapore's 30 by 30 target, and you mentioned this, and I'll ask you again whether you think we can be a bit more ambitious. Yeah. It's 30% of our nutritional needs, 30% of that by 2030. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a hidden meaning in that? In that there is a need to change where we get our nutritional sources from as well? In that we can't be using, as you say, still the same old animal proteins and things like that. Is there room to change our eating habits?
I'm not aware that there's any underpinning, you know, other strategy behind just meeting the 30% needs.
Okay.
But indirectly, you're right. Because this move towards more local production is also partly skewed in a sense, you know.
Mm.
If you break that 30% down, in fact, it's 20% of vegetables and fruits and 10% of protein. And of that 10% protein is eggs, fish, and then the alternative proteins like cultured meat and so on, you know. So implicitly, you'd say that, yeah, you know, there's kind of an indirect way to perhaps get people to eat more locally produced food, perhaps more vegetables in times of crisis.
Mm.
Now, there's another angle here, which I also, you know, one of my hobby horses is that it's not just eating the commercially available vegetables. I like to put in the pitch that most people should be eating what I call indigenous vegetables. Okay. The vegetables that when I was growing up, my mother used to cook, which you can't commonly buy.
It seems to be going, I mean, you see less and less of that as well.
Because, very much so.
Exactly.
You know? Exactly. And as you said earlier, our supermarkets respond to demand, get the supply. They try to anticipate what consumers want, and then they go backwards, work backwards with the supply chain. And then the farmers respond by growing what the supermarkets want.
Mm.
And this is what modern supply chains are all about. So what I want to end the message with is that consumers can have a very big role in affecting the supply chain by what they want. See, one of the most, again, encouraging, I think, trends in Singapore is that the demand for sustainably produced food has increased, which is really great.
Yes.
For a country that has relatively high, you know, household income, where we can actually afford to eat expensive stuff, it's great to actually know that. And this is anecdotal reports when I talk to my colleagues, you know, in some of the big institutions who buy food, now say that they're detecting an increased demand for sustainably produced fish, vegetables, even rice. You know, and to me, all these are really good harbingers of the future.
Yeah. Give me some examples of the indigenous
vegetables.
Yeah.
Sure.
Give me some examples.
Okay, my two favorite ones are this. One is four angle bean. I don't know if you know four angle bean, it's wing bean.
Okay.
It's a climber.
Okay.
And the pods are about, you know, let's say 10 to 15 centimeters. And you can even eat it fresh. You don't have to cook it. In fact, it used to be very popular amongst our Malay colleagues. Where they eat it fresh with belacan, sambal belacan.
Okay.
And it's totally delicious. And it's a very nutritious vegetable. Lots of roughage, vitamins. The common name is angle bean, or we call it four-angle bean, or wing bean, because the bean seems to have wings inside the pod, you know what I think?
Okay.
The second example I just like to give, it's one of my popular vegetables, is this flower.
Mm.
In Chinese, it's called ye lai xiang. A lot of people don't realize that flower is very nutritious and can be eaten. And you can't buy it anymore in Singapore.
Yes.
But if you go to, let's say, Bangkok, Chatuchak Market, you can see lots of it around.
Okay.
You know, it's cooked in soup, in omelets, you know. Because when I was growing up, my mother used to give us that in soup. Because it's really nutritious.
Yeah. Well, again, it goes back to how our eating habits have evolved and our demand for it has evolved to meet supply as well, because we're getting all sorts of food and vegetables from other places. As I will start to conclude this, and let me bring you back to something that you've said before in a piece that you've written. You said Singapore securitized water, right, as a source, and many, many decades ago. But with food, I would argue, and you say this, that we have not securitized food at all. Can you explain a little bit what that means and what steps need to be taken?
Certainly. In fact, I'm prepared to now change my mind slightly. Okay. I think certainly, you know, when I started, you know, on this journey of, you know, talking about food security in Singapore, you know, let's say 10 years ago, there was very little awareness that Singapore was so insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But securitizing food means that we elevate it to the level of importance like water or even the military.
Mm.
See, decades ago, this government decided to securitize water and said that it's an important issue for our national survival. So we invest resources in it, change policy, put in money behind it, technologies and so on. And today we're in a very good position.
Mm.
Right? So much so that in the near future, we might be almost totally, you know, independent in terms of water, you know, security,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Now food, even though we've moved from the 10-90 model to the 30-70 model, we're still a long ways away. I would say that we've made good progress, especially since 2018-19, the crisis, and then now with the COVID-19, it's really elevated the concern about food. So we're investing a lot more now. Now, what's still not known is whether in the next 2 or 3 years, all the investments will indeed make us a lot more food secure, because all the work is going on at the moment, you know, building more farms,
sustainable
farms, new ways of growing food and so on, you know. But I'm hoping that even without full securitization of food, as a security matter, we've taken some very big steps in Singapore.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about food security is if you look at sort of international studies, we usually rank quite highly.
We do.
People say Singapore has done well. But to the layman, it's sort of contradictory because here we are a small country which imports so much of our food. How is it that you say that we are actually doing well in terms of food security when we don't have the kind of land and the flexibility that other countries may have? What's the difference there?
It's a very good question, Jamie. You see, all these international indexes are based on a certain set of rubrics and metrics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, affordability, availability, safety, and then natural resources.
We do well on a lot of them, as I can tell.
And the weightings are different, you know. Mm-hmm. So we do very well. I usually like to tell people that many of these indexes are like beauty contests. You do very well superficially, but you look beneath the surface and you're so vulnerable.
Mm.
So therein actually lies the issue. Yeah, itself, you know, we've got to really understand and not become complacent by the fact that others view us.
Okay.
Now, the other angle to look at is that national security is very different from household security.
Mm.
You can have nationally very food secure, but again, at household level, we still have many, many food insecure households.
Yes.
Who can't afford food. You know, so all these articles about Singapore being a food paradise, you know, why there's still hungry people, that really illustrates this particular point. That household food security is something that we still need to spend a lot of effort on.
Yes.
How do we ensure that households are resilient? Other countries like India, they've got laws that show that every household, however poor you are, gets a minimum supply of food. It's an act of parliament that actually does that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not preaching that we do that in Singapore, you know, but certainly we need to see how we can develop more household food security.
Mm-hmm. Level, As a last question before I let you go, going back to 30 by 30.
Okay.
Do you think there's room for greater ambition? Since it's been announced, it's not been very long ago. We've seen so much happening in the last 1 year, even 2 years. Might we be in a better, stronger position, even more than 30% by 2030?
Yeah. Well, as a planning exercise, I would say certainly.
Okay.
As a pragmatist, I would say let's go stepwise.
Sure.
Because we don't want to create more problems by being overambitious. Because all farming has what we call negative externalities. Yeah, we want to minimize the negative externalities like pollution, blah, blah, blah.
Of course.
To heavy energy footprint, by making sure that there's a balance between the output, the positive output, which is food, and the negative externalities. So I would say, while for planning purposes, I think we can, for practical purposes, I think we could go stepwise.
Well, on that note, thank you very much, Paul, for joining me.
You're very welcome. It's been very enjoyable chatting with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Climate Conversations. This podcast is part of CNA's broader coverage of climate change at cna.asia. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website, app, and on iTunes and Spotify. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Su Ling, and Aaron Low. This podcast has been recorded on Sennheiser. I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.